Welcome to this lecture on virtual machines. So last time we looked at the basic steps in our Prolog machine, and that was calls corresponding to literals and unification statements. Unification statements, which kind of do are the kind of the is the working horse of the of all of the computations being executed for a Prolog program. So unification, a unification statement. Why is it strange? So a unification statement may look as follows. So we have on the left-hand side a variable and on the right-hand side a term. And this term could also be a variable or something more complex. And then at runtime we expect that for X a reference is a reference corresponding to that variable is pushed on top of the stack, and for T we expect that the term is built up. And then we have two representations of terms, which then are unified by means of a dedicated instruction unify. And this dedicated instruction of the virtual machine unify will call the runtime function unify, which really traverses the two heap representations of terms and compare them and try to unify them. And unification, once again, means that if this concurrent, or you might say this in sync traversal of the two terms hits on the one hand to an unbound variable and on the other hand to a term, then the variable is bound to the term. So that's kind of the idea of this runtime function unify. And we noted already last time that this runtime function relies on, uses three auxiliary functions. One auxiliary runtime function, this is the runtime function trail. This was meant to record the bindings. And we will later come back to that, because when we find out that our current selection of clauses was wrong, then we have to backtrack and do the reverse, the binding of variables. So therefore, for that purpose, we need this trailing. And then the backtracking, this was this when now we may wonder at which point the execution of a clause may fail. Well, it may fail since unification may fail, since the basic execution step of a Prolog program may fail. And that is, if two terms are, we try to unify two terms which are not unifiable. So, for example, first we say X should be equal to A, and then in the next step we ask X should be equal to B, then this cannot happen, and then the execution will fail. Yeah. So now we do not yet know what to do in order from such a point where a failure is detected, how to continue from there. So therefore, we introduced a second runtime function. This was this function backtrack. And this function backtrack we still have not yet implemented, but it kind of takes the provisions so that the runtime system can do the backtracking. Okay, so that was these two things. And then we had a third runtime function, which we used in our unify procedure. That was the auxiliary function check. And that checking was meant to perform the occur check. So this is something which we should try to implement right away now. So now what does this occur checking mean? So in that sense, assume that really the X on the left-hand side is an unbound variable, and if it is meant to be unified with the term T, then we would kind of try to set the reference object corresponding to X to T. So that would be our basic approach, but this only works if X itself does not occur inside T. And whether it occurs inside T or not, this is checked by this function check. So the check expects two references on top of the stack. One is a pointer pointing to a ref object. So this is a variable. And the other one is a pointer to the address of a term representation. And then it will traverse the term representation to see whether the variable occurs inside or not. Okay? So that's kind of the idea. So that now it turns out that this checking of doing this occur check is a costly operation. So therefore, for that reason, practical compilers, which you find, so there are various Prolog compilers. I don't know whether you have checked a little bit. At least if I search through my Ubuntu package system, then I easily can, I don't know how many, but at least two Prolog compilers I can download. I think there is this, what is it? Now I think there is one which is called, I think Quintus is there. And there's another one. Some GNU Prolog, I think, is also there. And so, when you play around with them, then they typically provide a flag by which one can switch off the occur check. And in some sense, you might do that, and because you believe you are a perfect programmer, you will never, in the course of executing your program, you will never try to unify a variable with a term containing that variable. But that is kind of perhaps a little bit, I would say, it is a so you better do not trust on that, because as I said last time, the real operational behavior of a Prolog program can be quite involved, and then it is very difficult. Therefore, it is very difficult to make strong assumptions about the terms which will occur at runtime and which will not. So, but for efficiency reasons, people still tend to switch that check off, and that means that the implementation of the runtime function is particularly simple, because we simply return always true. And true means everything is fine. The check is passed. So at least in the way how I defined it, returning true would mean no problem, you can do the binding. Otherwise, we could the checking would be implemented as could be also be implemented as follows. Remember or recall that U is the address of an R object, which we want to bind, and so it's unbound currently. V is the address of a term. And now we may first check whether this term is exactly also an unbound variable, that is whether U equals V. In this case, we know we have hit the U, so therefore we return false. Otherwise, if the V is kind of pointing to a struct, to a constructor application of with n arguments, we might iterate through the arguments and try to recursively do the checking there. And if the check succeeds, so then there was no problem. But if the check fails, so returns false, then we found a problem down there, so therefore we report false. And otherwise we continue. And if we did not find a violation of the occur check, then the for loop continues and does nothing. And so in the end, we can return true. And you note here, please note here, that here we only have checked for U equals V and for the struct. We did not check for atoms, because in an atom there is no variable, so everything is fine. Okay, so that was the implementation of the curl check. You see, it's not a complicated function, but it's recursive, and it is as costly as the term which we have to traverse for the occurrence of U. And if you have many variables to, if terms contain many variables, and then you might often traverse terms for the occurrence of that particular variable, and then that is costly. So therefore, really, for efficiency reasons, people kind of give up, if you like, soundness or correctness of the program, and just switch it off. So these Prolog people are a little bit sloppy with respect to semantics, in my impression. But I do not want to insult any of Prolog programmer if there's one in the audience. Yeah. So, yeah, now that kind of completes our implementation of the unify, of the unification goal. And up to the holes of trail and backtrack, which we just keep in mind, and we will implement them later. So there is, so now it is time for discussion. So as you perhaps, or as I try to convince you, all these kind of ideas of implementing are meaningful and consistent, but not the only way. So there are always multiple ways to construct such machines. And so what you should learn here is not only by learning by heart the schemes which we apply, but also understand the methods and the design choices, and so that you can design your machine in a skilled way. So therefore, we might start wondering whether this was a straightforward code generation, but we might wonder whether this was the best one and whether there's room for improving it. Now, how should there be room to improve it? We will have to somehow deal with X, deal with T. So what is the problem? The problem is that we build up the T, and T is known at compile time, and then we dynamically traverse the T, and afterwards we throw T away. So in that sense, in many cases at least. So in some cases, we do not throw it away. For example, if the X so far is unbound, then we really have to build up the T. Yeah, because the T then will be the binding. X will be bound to the T. But if X at runtime happens to be already built up to the full T, then we compare the X with the T, and then we throw the T away because it's already there. You see the point? So the point is that in some cases, not always, but in some cases, we built up the T and it was completely in vain. And so the question is, and what does it mean it was in vain? It was in vain in so far that we built up we put these objects into the heap and then later throw them away. So now we might say, okay, so we throw them away, so what's the point? But this throwing away is not for free. So the garbage collector must do some work to collect them. And otherwise, if the garbage collector does not work immediately, then the heap fills up. And filling up the heap is very dangerous but it is costly because Prolog is known to consume a lot of space anyway. And so we better try to avoid allocating garbage whenever we can. So therefore, we wonder whether we can avoid to construct the T. How can we avoid constructing the T? No, well, the idea is, well, instead of first constructing the T and then calling a generic unification procedure, this runtime function unify for X and T, we kind of do translate the T into instructions which compare the binding of X with T. So consider the simple case that we have the unification statement which we have in our program, broader program, is x equals a. So then, so far, we would build up, we allocate a in the heap, push a reference to a on top of the stack, and then call unify with x and this a. But we could also kind of translate this into code which compares x with a directly, because a is known, so nothing has to be built up. And we save the allocation of the a. So clearly this is not so much, it's just the a. But also this little garbage helps, because that's always the thing. That is a nuisance. You always allocate these little things just for one, two steps, and then you throw them away again, and they fill up your memory. Yeah? So you see the point? Instead of, once again, instead of creating a symbolic representation of the A and then doing the generic unification, we specialize the unification so that it takes only one argument, namely the X, and unifies the X with the A. Yeah? That's the idea. So technically this means that we now do the pushing of a reference to the left-hand side corresponding to the X, and then we do not build up the T, but instead translate the nodes of T into instructions which performs the unification with the corresponding nodes. That's the idea. Okay, so this looks now like that. So the code for this unification statement x equals t then is first consists of first putting the reference for the x and that then doing the unification. Okay, so it's in some sense looks similar, but it's different because we do not this second thing before looked as building up the T. This is code A for T, and then followed by the instruction unify, and this we have quick collapsed to this code U. Now the question is what this code U for T might be. So now let us get confidence in that it works, we may start with the simple things. So what are this, and these are one might say, atoms and variables, so how important is that? But actually this is the most important case, because in many places in Prolog programs you do have just to do these unifications between variables or variables and constants. So this is not a boring case, but this is a very important case. So the question is how does one do the unification there? And so this is not so difficult. So if you want to unify, the situation is we have a reference to the left-hand side of the unification statement on top of the stack. And now comes the code, the unification with an atom A. Okay? So what do we have to do? We have no idea. But we have an easy way out. We invent a new instruction for it. And this is this unify with atom A. Okay? Likewise, if the term on the right-hand side is an unbound variable, this is this x, then we invent a new instruction which does the unification with this unbound variable, fresh variable. Not unbound, uninitialized variable x. And then we have this, the right-hand side could also be an underscore, or then we have this, then we do the binding, but there is no binding to be done, because it is unbound, and therefore we just throw it away. We just pop. And otherwise, if we unify with an already initialized variable, we do this uref, and we already have a kind of a collection of things to wonder about and to invent. So these four instructions we should invent, and then we proceed to the more complicated case when the T starts with the constructor. Yeah? But first these simple cases. So the first thing is this atom unification with the atom A. So this is here. So assume on top of the stack is an unbound variable, a reference to an unbound variable, then what will happen? Okay, then the U atom A will construct an atom A and bind the R to this A. Yeah? And then pop the reference to the variable on top of the stack. So it's just this. Yeah, just this. Okay, so this is a piece of code we can write directly into the instruction, but this is only the case if on top of the stack is a reference to an unbound variable. If on top of the stack is a reference to is already a reference to an atom A, then fine. Then unification succeeds, and we simply pop that reference. Yeah? And so nothing has to be done. Now, in the case that these two situations do not occur, then we are in this case, and then a unification will fail, and therefore we can safely backtrack. And that we do by calling our famous and fabulous backtrack function. I forgot to explain to you that in the case that we bind a variable, we will also call this function trail in order to record a potential binding of the unbound variable. Yeah? Okay? So that is the U atom, and we see that is what we want to have. So by that, the unification with the atom A has been successfully implemented. So this seems plausible to us. Now let us see what we do in the other cases. So what happens if we have something on top of the stack, we have a reference to something. So this corresponds to the X. Now the right-hand side is an unbound variable I. An uninitialized variable I. Uninitialized variable means that this is a local variable, so it has a corresponding entry down there in the stack at frame pointer plus I, and there's nothing has been written inside that location so far. Now we know the binding for this variable, and this is namely exactly that what is on top of the stack. So therefore we set that we copy the reference on top of the stack down into this on top of the stack down in this into the local variable and pop the stack. That's it. Yeah? But that now or subsequently the variable the ith variable will be initialized and we have a value for it. Okay, now comes the pop. So what happens there? So pop says, okay, the reference is no longer needed. We throw it away. Why? Because we have to do a unification between that is what is on top of the stack and this this anonymous variable, which is recorded nowhere. So that means we do not have to do anything. Okay, now the only interesting thing is at some points, however, we may still use this unification runtime function, unify. And that is when we have to unify the reference on top of the stack with the value of an already bound variable. So this is in the case for when we do this uref with the variable with relative address I. Okay, so this means since it is already initialized in the stack frame, we have already a reference to something in the stack frame at relative address I, we have a reference to something, which is a term, which might be a variable, which might be something. So there is already a term. It has already been built up before. So this is the difference of from before. Before we had first to build up and then do the unify. Now there is already a term there. So that we take that. And the other thing is, on top of the stack, we also have something. So which is a term which has already earlier been built up. And then we unify these two things. So this means, yes, we call the runtime function unify for these two references, but we do not beforehand construct terms. So we only will unify terms which are already there. So this is, from a memory management point of view, better, much better. Yeah. So that is this uref. And afterwards, after having done the unification, the reference on top of the stack is no longer needed. We throw it away. Yeah, that's it. Okay, now we have, is there any question? So if not, then now we may consider what happens if we have a constructed term. Then clearly, if the term is constructed, we have somehow to mimic the unification with this term. And where does unification start? It starts at the root. So we somehow have to do a traversal over the term. And we do that in a pre-order, that is also important, by a pre-order traversal over the term T. So this is in some now different. Recall, when we constructed this code A thing, when we constructed the arguments for a clause, no unification, just building up, that was a bottom-up traversal. It was a post-order traversal. Now we do a pre-order traversal. This means we start with doing something for the root and then proceed downwards to the children. Yeah? So that means if you want to do this U code for a constructed term, F applied to T1 to TN, we first have to do something. We first have to do something for the root. And the root means somehow we have to compare the reference on top of the stack with the constructor, which is in this which represents this this F, yeah, with the constructor Fn. And yeah, and then now that is the first thing. And then we have let me just kind of highlight the components which must be available, which we must provide for the whole construction. Then clearly, this is one aspect of the code which we generate to do the test of the root. Then additionally, we have to deal with the recursively deal with T1 to TN. Yeah? So if the test was, the comparison was successful, we continue with the comparison of T, with doing the unification with T1, and so on until TN, if everything is successful. Now it could also, so now that is kind of the optimistic view that the comparison succeeds. And that there are always terms in matching constructors. Now it could also be that unification succeeds, but on one side that we have a variable. So this means on top of the stack we have a variable which we must unify with the term which we have not yet constructed. So what can we do? This is the situation when we have to build up the term. And this is this building block. This is done at starting at address A. This is here. So this now I make this building up. I make here. I highlight in blue. Yeah. So once again, this construction, the check, the ustruct F comma N will compare the reference on top of the stack and see what it make a case distinction on where it points to. If it finds a constructor F there, everything is fine, and it descends to T1, and so on. But if it finds a reference to a variable, to an unbound variable on top of the stack, then it cannot kind of continue with T1 to TN. It then says, okay, the unification probably will succeed. I now have to build up the term. And this is in the blue section. And this is starting with address A. Okay? This is the use struct, the idea of this use struct instruction, which we have to implement then later, clearly. Now, so that was for the why there is this this building and creation of bindings has to be added to the has to be added to the plane traversal, top down traversal of the term. Now comes one more thing that we have to do this, to implement this traversal. And this, since it is so we need, for that, we need kind of, so in which color I may, maybe I go back to the color red, and then say that here we inserted extra instructions. So these extra instructions are necessary for the navigation inside the term T. And that we will soon also look at. Okay? So these are the ingredients for the ingredients of the code generation. Perhaps one more thing. No, so I can use this. Here inside this, the last. So sun 1 proceeds to the first sun. Sun n proceeds to the nth sun. And up goes back to the finishes the execution of this of the unification of this of the constructed term, and therefore contains a jump to the first address behind all the unification code. This is the B. Yeah, so this B here jumps to the next instruction after the unification. And by that, the unification is finished. Okay, so now we have still various kind of things to worry about. So let us, having seen this this brute force overview, we might first take a look at things slowly and try to understand this building block first. Yeah? And now looking into that building block, what do we see? So we see three activities. The first thing is this check thing, and that is we can, even if the construct on one side we find an unbound variable, on top of the stack we find an unbound variable, we cannot directly go to build up the term T and do the binding, because unification could still fail because the variable on top of the stack might occur inside the term T. Now, that we have to find out. And how do we do it? Well, that is done by this macro check, which we will kind of look at on the next slide, how this checking will be done. So the next component is, okay, if the check succeeds, everything is fine, we can build up the term and do the binding. So build up the term, this is done here. So this is kind of still on top of the stack. We still have the reference to, no, yeah, the still we still have the reference to the to the unbound variable. Now code A will produce on top of it an instance of the, will build up the term T. And then bind will do the binding. And therefore we need an extra instruction, which is this bind, which will do the binding and then throw away these through references. So now, now you have seen these three ingredients of the building block. Let us go to do the first thing, this checking. And you see, so now I again throw away these two things, which we have already, and look at that. Now this macro check has two arguments. The first argument is the variables occurring in this F, and then the relative address row. So why do we need the variables inside, which occur inside the F? So clearly, we see, we look for, we want to know, we have a reference on top of the stack. Now this reference, we have to check whether this variable occurs somewhere in the T. Now, therefore, clearly, it can only occur inside of the variables, because outside the variables, there are no variables. Now, these variables themselves may not be, so they may, compile time, may be variables, but at runtime, they may already have been bound. So, therefore, we have to look at the values of these variables, yeah, and then compare these. So, this is what the occur check has to do. So, accordingly, so now this IVAS of a T, this takes the set of variables which already have been initialized. Yeah, those which have not yet been initialized can also not have been copied on top of the stack, because if they were would have been copied off the stack, then they would already that would mean that beforehand they would have been initialized. So therefore, these uninitialized variables, if the T is an uninitialized variable, it is definitely different from the variable on top of the stack. So therefore, we only have to look at the occurrences of variables in the term T which are already initialized. And now, then if these are the assume that these variables are y1 to yd, then we would have to then these variables are sitting somewhere in the, these are local variables of the clause. So we have references to their current bindings in the stack frame. These are the current bindings of these variables in the stack frame. And now, for these are terms. At runtime, these are terms. And on top of the stack, we have a reference to a variable. So therefore, we only have to check whether the thing on top of the stack occurs in these terms. So this is done by this instruction check. Now, what does this check do? It takes the unbound variable on top of the stack and takes the reference which we to the local, dereferences this reference and compares. If they are and calls this runtime function check, which does the occur checking. And if this fails, if the check returns false, that is, the variable occurs, then we do backtracking. Otherwise, we do. Otherwise, everything is fine, and we do nothing. Okay, so by that we kind of. Yes. Okay. So that's the first thing. So now we have, going back, now we know, now the mysterious macro, the mysterious macro, which I have marked in red, now we know what it is. So it is a sequence of this instructions check for all the initialized variables occurring in the term. Okay, then we do this building. We know how that is. I do not have to explain it. So the next thing is the binding. So that is here. The instruction bind, what is it? So on top of the stack, we have built up the term, and below that we have an unbound variable. So therefore, this is the situation when bind is applied. And then it is what we do is we do that we build we redirect the reference in here. The reference in here to this binding on top of the stack, and that's it. And besides, additionally, in order to keep track of what's going on, we also call trail for this variable which we have bound. Okay, so that was bind, and that was perhaps not so critical. So that now comes, now let us again, sorry for going this forward and backward, but we always have to meditate over this scheme here, so that now we have fully understood what's going on in this block. Now, what we are interested in is what's going on in that block. So for that, once again, we have to know what's going on here, what the use struct will do, and we have to see what these navigation things, sun 1 to sun n, and this up instruction will do. So that is, so the first thing is this use struct, which will do the test. So the testing will check for this unbound variable thing. If we have an unbound variable, then we jump to this A, to the reference A, to the location in the code, the code location A, for the building. And otherwise, we compare if the test, if the on top the topmost reference is not an unbound variable, we then compare, see whether it points to the constructor F. And if it does not point to a constructor F, then we know it will unification will fail, and we will go to backtracking. Otherwise, if it is F, now what will we do then? Then we will recursively descend to the children, and in order, so we will recursively descend to the children. Now we will have to go to the first child, then to the next child, and to the and so on. So that means, in order we cannot replace the topmost reference by the reference to the first child. Why? Because then we will never find the second child. So therefore we have to keep the current reference in order to process the successive childs. So therefore we keep the current reference on top of the stack, but additionally push on top the reference to the first child, and then proceed. And afterwards, when we are done with all the children, then they are all gone, and then the current reference is no longer needed, and we can pop it. That is the end of the game. So therefore, we arrive. So here is once again the code. Here is the comparison which we have to do. Then we keep it. We push here the reference first to the first child. Then do the unification code for that. Then the unification code in the end for the first child will pop this instruction. So we are at the same, after having processed the first son, we still have the reference to the full tree T. And then we push the next son and so on. So these are all these sun things. And then in the end, when we are done, we pop the instruction, we pop the reference on top of the stack and proceed with B. So that gives us now, having given you the idea, now let us implement the instructions. So first this use struct. Use struct. Now I wonder what this I here means. The instruction useStruct implements the test of the root node. So the first thing is that one we have already discussed extensively. If the useStruct instruction finds a reference to an unbound variable on top of the stack, it will do nothing but jump to the address A. So that's fine. Yeah? So then comes the building block and we are happy. Now, the other thing, the other critical thing is that it, this is this situation when it finds a reference to a struct F, N. In this case, it simply does nothing. Yeah, it leaves the reference on top of the stack because then we will descend to the sun. But we leave the reference on top of the stack. Yeah? So in that sense, this use struct instruction, although it is not so difficult. Yeah? And in all other cases, it will backtrack. Okay? So, but this use struct, yeah, so this reference, which was there before the use struct, will only be popped here at the app. So currently, we leave it on top of the stack. Now comes this sun instruction, which is meant for the navigation to the corresponding sun. So, in the situation before the sun I instruction is that on top of the stack, we have a reference to a struct. Now, sun one will push a reference to the first argument. So that means sun one will push this reference on top of the stack. And sun I will just take the ith element, in this case this one, and push it on top of the stack. Okay, that's all. And it will not, so there's one minor thing, it will not, see, we always insist on that before we push something on top of the stack, we first do the maximal dereferencing in order to kill extensively growing chains of references. Okay? And then comes now the only remaining thing is the up instruction. That happens once we have processed all the children of the root node. Now, having processed all the children of the root node, we kind of have the situation where all the unifications went fine and succeeded. And so on top of the stack, we have only the reference to the root node, and then this going up means popping this reference and additionally jumping to the B. That's it. So now you see this sun I instruction, the up instruction, and the struct instruction, and the use struct instructions were all not very difficult, but altogether they gave a quite complicated behavior. Okay, so now it's time for doing an example. So otherwise, we get a little bit dizzy in our heads. So here is our fabulous term, which we have considered several times. We have used it for building up the term. Now let us see how we translate it to unification code. And you see here, this unification code is not so small. Actually, it's quite large. And why is it? Why is it so large? It is because we do, in some sense, for the same piece of syntax, we construct several pieces of code. Namely, one for doing this traversal and another one for building up the terms once we find that on the unification with this term will hit an unbound variable. Yeah? So let us see. So first we start on the top level. So we would start with this F. Now this F, so this is on the top level. We therefore have, so this starts with this use struct instruction. And it ends with the binding here. Yeah? And now the building block for this use struct instruction is here. This is the building block for the unification of the whole term. Yeah? And you see here in this building block, let us perhaps take so maybe I just indicate it also here. So we, no. Sorry. Doing it in red. Yeah, so we jump here. There. So this building block contains the construction of the term. This is this code A. This is here. And we have seen that because the first variable is initialized, therefore this put ref. And then the y, which is uninitialized, therefore put var. Then we construct the g. This is this put g, put struct g. Then comes the a with the put atom a. Then the set with put var 3. And afterwards the put struct f3. So that is a very well-known code to us. Now before that I have this check 1. So why check 1? I only have to check the variable which is initialized, that is the x. So therefore, x has relative address 1, therefore check 1. Okay? So that's, and the bind afterwards we also have seen. So that is the construction code for the whole expression. Now, inside this code, this u struct f3, then we have, I may now remove this kind of reference here. And then we may look at, so we have the sun 1, we have the sun 2, and somewhere must also be the sun 3. Ah, and here the sun 3. Sorry. No, I made it wrong. So, sun 2 and sun 3. So these are the for the three arguments of the F. Yeah? And perhaps we look at the second and the third argument because that is shorter. The second argument is A, so therefore we have only this U atom A here, and set is an uninitialized variable, therefore a u var 3 there, and afterwards we have this up, the up, and the b 1 there is the first reference behind the whole code. And so what only is missing now, maybe I also mark that in green, is this part here, and that is all the code for the unification for the subterm gxy. Yeah? And gxy is again a constructed term, so therefore it contains this navigation through the term and the build code, the building block. And that makes it complicated because now there's again this building block. So let us perhaps I mark it again with blue. So this is now again a building block. So we have a building block for the full expression and also a building block for a sub-expression. So this means code duplication. And that is kind of, in some sense, this is bad because by that the code grows. And that is, you see it here literally in this little example, so it's not so small. So now, perhaps again we look at this building block for the gxy. Now gxy, again there is, we have to look only for the initialized variable, that is the x, therefore a check 1. And then we have to construct the gxy, that is we put the reference to x, we put the variable y, and then we put the struct g, and then we bind. So that's it. So this blue thing we have understood, and now for the remaining code for the gxy is here the construct. So now I perhaps wipe out all the other parts because they kind of confuse us. So now we can concentrate on that. So we have here the unification with a struct U, and then we have the navigation to the first sun, the navigation to the second sun, and the up. And this B here is the first code. It jumps. This is the address of the first instruction behind the unification with the unification code for this first argument. Therefore, it is the processing of the second argument. Therefore, it goes to this sun 2. Okay, so, and now we see here in between, in these places, we only have the implementation of the two arguments, x and y, of g, and the first one is initialized, therefore u ref 1, and the other one is uninitialized, therefore u var 2. So that's it. So you see this, I hope, so it was not in a linear way that I tried to explain it, but tried to show you the hierarchical structure of that code. But clearly, you do the code generation, and then you get this linear sequence, and perhaps if one sees more than 5 instructions, one gets a little bit nervous whether one is able to pass it, but I hope by that you were able to recover the schema, generation scheme. And actually, I think I have not done that by hand, but I have a little implementation of that, and then I let it generate, and then one does make less mistakes. So in general, we see, once again, we see that for every constructed, sub-expression, we might have the building code. And that means for every if the size of the term is n, then we can have, in some sense, n times this building code. And so this is n squared. The size is n squared in the asymptotic way. So, but the size is actually smaller because the constant before is, I guess, 1/2, and it's only for the big terms where one has to do this. For the leaves, one always has the single instruction unification, namely. Yeah, for variables and atoms. So therefore, it is not so bad. So it's not really quadratic. But we see here, even in this little example, that the code may really get larger. And in particular, it gets particularly large if the terms are deep. Not if they are wide, but if they are deep. So the worst case is a linear sequence of length n. And one would have really... I think n minus 1 times n minus 2 half or so. But, and now comes, well, that is always wrong, but it seems at least in some books one finds that these deep terms are rare. So if Prolog programmer, so it's a matter of taste what the Prolog programmer likes to write down, but typically he will not write very deep terms. He will write terms which are one or two constructors deep, and that's it, and no more. And then that's not no problem, because then two constructors deep, this is our example, then everything is acceptable. Yeah. So therefore, this scheme, which is in some sense expensive in code size, is not so big a problem. Also, there's this other point that Prolog programs tend to be comparatively succinct, because you have powerful, this unification operation is a powerful operation, and therefore I guess it's much more succinct than writing a C program, and so therefore programs are not so large. And if they are not so large, then you have a pretty good chance that the code is, well, has an acceptable size. So if you think how large Java programs tend to be, then this is negligible. Okay, so that was unification, and you saw that it is, although everything was started out to be very simple, at some point it started to be a little bit more tricky, like this one here. And it is kind of, so the idea behind it, the conceptual idea is interesting, and people call it also partial evaluation. So this unify is a runtime function which we could call, but if we could the idea was to specialize this general purpose function and make optimal use of all the information which we have at compile time. And in this case, the term T on the right-hand side, and to make use of that. And this leads to a little bit of code explosion, but in the end, it is much more efficient. Okay, so now we have all the ingredients to implement the body of a clause, because in the body of a clause, we have sequences of literals and unification goals. So therefore, what does the code of a clause consist of beyond just the code for the sequence of goals in the body? Yeah? And so that is the question, what do we have to do extra? So clause is somehow related to a implementation or to a definition of a procedure. Now think of C, for example. So if you have a procedure want to translate a procedure declaration, so what do we have to do first? The first thing is to allocate the space for the locals. So we also had this extreme pointer. We don't care for extreme pointer here, but what we do have to do is to allocate the space for the locals. So that is important. And then comes the code for the body. And then in the end, we somehow have to kind of clean up. That is, we have to throw away the locals, have to return to the caller, have to return the results. So that was in essence, what we had to do. And that is the same thing what we have to do here. So the first thing is allocate space for the locals. Some locals have already been allocated, namely the parameters. But there are some more. And then we have to evaluate the body. So that's it, that we know. And then in the end, we want to give up the stack frame. So that's what we want to do. There's only one minor point which I might highlight a little bit. And that is this one. Because it turns out, or it will turn out, that we will not always be able to give up the stack frame. And that is one of the reasons why Prolog programs are so space-consuming. Because when a procedure is finished, you might not be able to throw away the stack frame. So this means the stack frames may pile up. Okay. So we will see the reason for it, not in a minute, but maybe soon. Hopefully soon. So let us take a look at a clause. So here is a clause. So it has a head, and we are now happy that in the head we only have the formal parameters, because the values for the formal parameters have been provided in the call. Yeah? So that's it. Now these are the x1 to xk. These are always be there. They are sitting kind of downwards in the stack frame, and on top of it come the further parameters, which are used for writing down and transferring information between the different goals in the body. So these are in some sense the real locals. Yeah, the parameters are one class of locals, and the extra locals for kind of auxiliary computations, these are the real locals which we now have to allocate. And then comes the goals G1 to GN, and then and then everything is fine. Now let us see. So in principle, we for simplicity assume that the locals are x1 to xm and x1 to xk, where k is less or equal to m, are those which are already sitting in the head. Yeah. And then, now what kind of now we have to do to dream up an addressing scheme to get the relative addresses for the locals. Now how do we do it? Well, we make our lives extremely simple just by using the index of the variable as relative address. So this is fine here because every variable has the same size. Every variable is bound to a reference to something. Everything has the same size. Very easy. We do not have to care about sizes of types. So for that we assume the first variable receives relative address 1. This means the frame pointer points to the last organizational cell. This is also a convenient convention which we have adopted in all our machines. So that's it. Okay. So now we have the address environment for translating the clause. And then, so now comes the code for the clause. So here is the clause, let us call it R, and the code C generates codes for clauses. And so there's no address environment handed over to this code C function. Why? Because there are no globals. So outside R is no variable. Yeah, so we do not need to hand over some address environment to the code C, but we will have an address environment inside the clause. This is this row, but this row is constructed exactly in this way. Okay, so in this way the row comes into being. Okay, so now once again we want to generate code for this our fabulous clause, and how do we do it? So clearly, it will contain the sequence, the clause for the first, the code for the first goal, then the code for the next goal, and so on in sequence. And because when one goal is done, then we simply proceed with the next goal, and that was our convention. And before that. So this is things which we can already do. But before that, we have to allocate space for the locals. And if there are M locals, we have to provide M memory cells. Yeah, we have to the stack frame has to contain, has to provide space for M variables. And afterwards, we want to give up the stack frame. So for these two things, we invent new instructions, namely this putenv thing. Putenv m allocates the space, and popenv tries to pop the stack frame, but also returns the control to the caller. Yeah, if the clause has successfully been executed, this means all the literals could be proven. Then we continue behind the call of this clause. And that is, we have to restore the frame pointer, we have to restore the PC. Yeah? So that's the ingredients. And now our task is now come up with an implementation of that and come up with an implementation of that. So here it is, pushenv. It's a very simple thing. We want to allocate, so the frame pointer points to the last organizational cell. On top of it are sitting some parameters, the k parameters, and now we want to make space for further locals, so we set the stack pointer to frame pointer plus n. So by that we have allocated the space for the locals. So very easy. Okay? Now what, and for the popenv, now you wonder what happens with the popenv, and I say, okay, popenv is not so easy, so we do it later. Okay, but even if we don't know what popenv does, we can generate code, and that is always our kind of, so it makes our life, so we already can feel as compiler constructors and code generators, so we do not know what we really generate, how it works, but we can generate. And we do it, so let us do it for this little example here. Now we have the full clause, we now can say for every variable in the body, whether it is already an initialized or an uninitialized occurrence. So please note, variables which are parameters, like the x and the y, always will be initialized because they have been initialized before the call. Yeah, so they have values. And now for this x, the x1 is meant to do communication inside the literals. So in here this f and a, so it's kind of a join what is computed here. And it is the x1 is the first occurrence of the this x1 here is the first occurrence. It is not initialized here, and here it is initialized. Yeah. So that's what we see. And now let's do the code generation. So what do we do? Okay. So now the first thing is we count the number of locals. X, Y, and X1, so therefore push and 3. Now, and it ends, everything ends with a popenv. So that is, now we have seen this. Now we might wonder, so what do we do then? Then there is the first, then there's f applied to X and X1, so this is a literal. So therefore, and I might write down the row equals X. Yeah, so this is our address environment. At least this is the natural way how to do it, namely to left to right kind of assign relative addresses to the variables. Okay, so the first thing is this F, X, X1. So that is a literal. Recall what we do there. So here is all the code for it. We mark A, so this is the stack frame. And this A is the first address behind. Then we put the X, and then we put the X1, and then we call the F2. And the X is initialized, therefore a put ref1. The X1 is not initialized, therefore a put var3. And the same thing happens here for the second literal, which is the AX1Y. The AX1Y, this is this one. And again, in the stack frame, we record the first address after the literal. This is this one. And now the two arguments are X1, which is now initialized. Therefore, it is an putref3. And the Y, which is also initialized, therefore a putref2, and afterwards a call to A2. Okay? So the code, I hope at least that this code does not contain any surprises. So you see in particular, these literals go really to very clean, to a very clean code, which looks precisely like a procedure call in C, or even a little bit simpler, and a simple call in a functional language. The only point is, so here it was so simple because we had no unification code. So for complex terms, we saw that code looks a little bit ugly, but the rest is very simple, very clean and easy. Okay. So that was so. Now we can are able to generate code for a single clause, and now it the only thing is which we have to recall is that clauses do not live on their own, but clauses are meant to define predicates. And now comes this crucial point in this machine. The same predicate could be defined by multiple clauses. And that now we have to take provisions for. So a predicate in general, like this Q thing, could be defined by a sequence of clauses. And, but there's still clearly now first the easy cases. If the predicate is defined only by a single clause. Okay, so that is an easy case because then the code for the predicate equals the code for the clause. Because then, if there we find a literal calling this predicate, we know, okay, we have to call, execute this clause, so we just jump to this clause. Yeah, so then that is, in some sense, an easy thing. So we might kind of do perhaps, in order to be very consistent, we should then perhaps write it like that. Q, comma K. This is the label. And that is the code for that. That is the code for that. Now, the really interesting thing, I will insert this label because that might be useful. The interesting thing is when the predicate is defined through several clauses. And that means, so then we have to organize the clauses in such a way that the first clause is tried. And then once, if it succeeds, then everything is fine. That is the way how we thought about it so far. But it may also fail. And then we need kind of to organize that then we proceed to the next clause and try that. Yeah? And this is this backtracking thing. So, it's time to kind of think a little bit closer. What happens, about this backtracking? And the first thing is, the first step when backtracking is initiated is that, or how is it initiated? Technically, we always initiated backtracking by calling this mysterious runtime function backtrack, of which we do not yet know what it really does. But now we may try to collect our ideas what should be done then. So the first thing is, we have to roll back the whole computation until, where to? In some sense, we could say we roll back the computation of the current clause and try the next clause. But it could be that there is no next clause. So what then would we have to do? Okay, so then backtracking has to go to the ancestor, literal, which is also somewhere in a clause. And then this clause also has failed. And therefore, we have to take the next clause there. But perhaps there is no next clause there. Now we have to again to go one step up. So this we could do dynamically by kind of giving up one kind of in this, if you think of the call stack, we could successively step through the call stack and then successively one after the other fail the current literals. But that is a little bit annoying. In particular, it is annoying if this is a long way. And so in Prolog, so saying one more practical thing, Prolog programmers, although they are enthusiastic about this backtracking thing, they do not use backtracking all the time. But in many cases, in many things, they try to be as deterministic as possible just for efficiency reasons. So this means backtracking, if you use such a programming style, then the place where when here something fails, you could be very deep inside a recursion which is completely deterministic. And that means you have to fail very far outside. And this you would not do by doing individually, stepping through all your call stack. And that means you would like to directly jump to the place where, to the nearest place on the call stack, up in the call stack, where an alternative is still open. And this is the backtrack part. In some sense, this corresponds to this exception business. Recall, when we did exceptions, we also did not fail one procedure call and a function call and then the next one until we arrived somewhere, but we directly jumped to the handler and blew off the whole call stack which was on top of it. And that we would like to do here also, and that we do by means of keeping track of the last backtrack point. And that is kind of the environment. So in this sense, you could think of it as an exception, which is raised when there's a backtrack thing, and you go back to this backtrack point. And try there, a handler, and the handler says, please go to the next alternative. Okay. Now that is, so that is what one thing what we have to do when doing this backtracking. We have to go to roll back the computation to the last backtrack point. And now rolling back is really means rolling back. That means all intermediate variable bindings must be unbound. And those variable bindings which must be unbound, we have trailed on the trail, trailed by means of this function trail. So therefore now we have two things to do. We have to understand what we do when trailing, and then we have to do how to understand what it means to roll back the computation. And now the question is, so let us now take a closer look at this fabulous runtime function trail. So the trail function is meant to record variables which have been bound. Now the question is, where is this information recorded? And so then we see we currently do not really have a very good data structure for it. And then the natural way out in this situation is to invent one. And this is this trail. Here is the trail. So it's a new data structure. And again, this is maintained in a stack-like discipline. And the only reason for this extra data structure is to record the bindings of variables. And so as it is a stack, so there is something like a trail pointer which points to the top of the stack. And that means the last occupied trail cell. Okay? So, and then additionally, we need this backtrack pointer. That is the pointer to the stack frame, where the last stack frame where an alternative is open. So, in some sense, this corresponds to the exception handler. Okay. And then a backtrack. So once again, a backtrack point is a stack frame for which there is an alternative open. So that means program execution possibly may occur to this return to this place. And now this here is the stack frame now in full detail. The organizational cells in full detail, and in particular with all the details which could be, which are important for a backtrack point. So, as the organizational cells of a stack frame, it clearly contains the positive continuation address because it's for a call. That's we know. Also, the frame pointer. That we know. But now it also contains more information, and these are these four pieces. And most prominently, it contains the negative continuation address also. Now, what is the negative continuation address? So that was, here this stack frame was made for the evaluation of a literal. Now, the evaluation of the literal has been done or started by means of a clause. Now this clause may fail, and in this case we need to try the next clause. And the address of the next clause, this is the negative continuation address. Yeah? This is the address of the next clause to be tried. And then, okay, so now we have understood even more then the only thing which now is strange is this one here. And these are, what are these? These are the heap point, the old heap pointer, the old trail pointer, and the old backtrack pointer. Now, since this is a potential backtrack point, so there is, there could be the out. So it's like with the exception pointer. So inside this, inside the call, we maintain a pointer to this stack frame. Now, if we turn to this stack frame, then this again, this could be fail. This could fail, and then we might want to recover the old surrounding backtrack point, and that is the last backtrack point which is around, and this is this BP old. Yeah, and then the other information which we need is we kind of want to know what is the status in the heap and the status in the trail when we started the computation, the current computation, and that is this HP old and the TP old. And then when we start evaluating this, the current alternative for this literal, then we may put more things into the heap, put more things into the trail, and then when we find everything fails and we go back to this stack frame, we kind of pop the heap pointer until the heap HP old, and we unbind the variables in the trail until we reach the TP old. Yeah? So this kind of freezes the situation before we try the current alternative, this HP old and the TP old. Yeah? Okay. Okay, so now let us see. So sometimes it's difficult to record that frame pointer -2 is the HP old or so. We might give them names and use kind of these. I don't know how often we really will use these macros, but FP old always refers to a particular location on the stack. So now you could think of them as also a macro for an expression in Fs and FP. So now let us see what the backtrack function would do. I announced boldly announced that we would kind of look at the trailing first, but that was wrong. So we now first let us look at this backtracking thing to get the very big picture. So what is the back? So where does backtracking is triggered? So this is a situation when we have somewhere. The frame pointer points somewhere, and we have the current backtrack pointer points to another stack frame. And this other stack frame now is this one which I mark here in yellow. Yeah, this is the current backtrack point. And this means, and in the current, so now we have descended into proving a lot of literals, and the current literal is pointed to by the frame pointer. In between there is no backtrack point, so now if computation fails, we have to return to this yellow stack frame. And that means the FP is kind of redirected. The FP is redirected to this, to the value of the backtrack pointer. So that's it. By that we return to that stack frame. Also, the heap pointer now is, so a lot of objects have been allocated onto the heap. We don't care about them anymore. We remove them in one go by additionally moving the value of the old heap pointer at the backtrack point into the current heap pointer, and also the trail pointer is the trail pointer is recovered, and so everything has been popped off, and we continue with the negative continuation address. Yeah, that is the main thing what we do. There is only one thing in between which we additionally do, and this is this resetting. Resetting of all the variables between the old trail pointer and the current trail pointer. Yeah? And that's all what backtracking does. Okay? Now we see that really this backtracking is not so of a wild thing. It just restores the values of the backtrack point into the current registers, and additionally resets all the variables which have been allocated in between, have been bound in between, and now but clearly this was only possible at the expense of one more auxiliary function, this resetting, and that now will be looked at next time. So for the moment, our time is over. We will continue next time with explaining how this unbinding of variables is managed. Thank you very much, and see you next time.